Welcome back to the Thinking Mind podcast. My name's Alex, I'm a consultant psychiatrist. Emotional intelligence is something we discuss all the time, but at the same time, it's often misunderstood, even in the circles of mental health professionals. We don't necessarily define it in clear terms, understand what to do with it, or how we can use it to improve our lives. With me to discuss emotional intelligence today is not someone from the mental health world, but actually from the business world. Today we have Professor John Wisniewski on the podcast. John Wisniewski is a clinical assistant professor at the Rice Jones Business School in Houston, Texas. At the Rice Jones School of Business, he teaches a whole course on emotional intelligence, in particular how it can be applied in business settings. So today we discuss how emotional intelligence can be clearly defined, the different ways that clinical researchers have defined it over the years and the models that they use. We discuss all the benefits that can be obtained from becoming more emotionally intelligent, but also the dark side of emotional intelligence and the difference between emotional intelligence and manipulation. If emotional intelligence is something that you've heard something about but want to understand in more depth, this is the podcast for you. This is the Thinking Mind podcast, a podcast all about psychiatry, psychology, psychotherapy, and related topics. If you like it, there are a few ways you can support it. You can give us a rating, share it with a friend, follow or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen. Or if you want to support us further, you can check out the Buy Me a Coffee link in the description. In addition, if psychotherapy is something that you're not only interested in, but want to try for yourself, I'm now offering one-on-one private psychotherapy sessions, both online or in person in the South London area. So if that's something you're interested in, you can email alexkurumitherapy@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and now here's today's conversation with Professor John Wisniewski. Thanks so much for joining me today.
It's delightful to be with you, Alex.
Today we're going to be talking about emotional intelligence. We're going to dive into your own career, what led you to teach your own course on emotional intelligence as part of an MBA at Rice University. But first, how do you define emotional intelligence?
Well, it's an interesting question, Alex, and I wish there was a straightforward answer. Let's start with a couple of basics. First of all, we know that emotions are the conscious person's response to events or stimuli in the environment. And where that response is both cognitive in nature, so we think something about an event or a stimuli, but it's also behavioral in nature, so we react, we respond. For example, if you're driving along the road and you encounter a pothole, that event will likely cause a sudden feeling of surprise, followed by us shouting something like, "Oh no," as we swerve to sort of avoid inflicting damage upon our vehicle. Typically, emotions are expressed suddenly due to some specific stimuli, and that expression is usually accompanied by high intensity that lasts for sometimes just a few seconds to perhaps a few minutes. I think it's important to understand the mechanics of emotions and sort of distinguish them from mood, where moods tend to be much more longstanding, longer in duration, and not a response to a specific event. So that dichotomy is a little bit important as we sort of explore emotional intelligence. But in order to provide you with a working definition for what emotional intelligence really is, I find it necessary to take you and your listeners on a bit of a history tour of cognitive science. And it really begins for us with a psychologist named David McClellan, who published a seminal article in the American Psychologist back in 1973, so 50 years ago, in which he argued, quite rightly in fact, that intelligence, cognitive aptitude, as measured by a myriad of aptitude tests, like here in the United States, all high schoolers take something called the Scholastic Achievement Test, or SAT, in order to gain entrance to college. That those kinds of cognitive aptitude tests were not accurate predictors of academic success. And he did this by simply trying to correlate SAT scores from high schoolers with their academic performance or grade point averages once they entered university. And when he found that there wasn't a strict correlation, he began asking questions about what might identify what else might be at play here, what might be a greater predictor than someone's cognitive aptitude. And in the process, McClellan interviewed lots of faculty members who were teaching students. And in these interviews, he began to hear things like, well, Sally really took initiative in her group work, or Joe exhibited a positive outlook in the classroom, or Chris took initiative to bring an interesting new idea to our discussion. And it was really from this seminal work that the scholarly community began its efforts to sort of identify and codify these other variables, these interpersonal variables that really predicted academic success. At about the same time in history, Howard Gardner, who's a famous psychologist from Harvard, first introduced the theory of multiple intelligences. And in his work, Howard suggested that there may well be in upwards of 8 distinct intelligences, including, for example, things like musical intelligence, linguistic intelligence, spatial intelligence. And indeed, one of those 8 intelligences that he defined was something called interpersonal intelligence, which really was this idea that we could understand and relate with others very well. And I'll sort of spare you and your audience some of the messy details over what has transpired over the past 50 years in the academic literature, and suggest to you that scholars seem to have coalesced around 2 prominent operationalized definitions of emotional intelligence. The first, which was offered by Peter Mayer, John Salovey, and David Caruso, defines emotional intelligence very specifically as the ability to perceive and express emotion, the ability to integrate emotional data in the cognitive process, so how we make decisions, the ability to understand the root causes and the likely progressions of emotions, and the ability to manage those identified emotions, both in ourselves and in the relationships that we have. What I think is interesting about this definition is that it really treats emotional intelligence as a set of 4 distinct skills. And those skills in this model can be objectively measured and, just like any other skill, developed and improved. The second operationalized definition, which came a little bit after chronologically the Mayer, Salovey, and Caruso work, is offered by Richard Boyatis and Daniel Goleman. And they define emotional intelligence as a set of 13 learned competencies for which we recognize our own feelings and the feelings of others, such that we can motivate ourselves and manage emotions effectively both for ourselves and for others. And some of these learned competencies include things like conflict management, influence, adaptability, empathy. And while it may provide some dissonance that there's 2 sort of prominent operationalized definitions of what we're talking about today, there is, in fact, a wonderful article written by Carrie Chernice in the Industrial and Organizational Psychology Journal called Emotional Intelligence Toward Clarification of a Concept, in which Carrie argues that there's really no problem here with there being multiple definitions. In fact, these definitions probably have more in common than they would appear to be dissimilar. There is sort of a practical matter of sort of choosing a definition for purposes of not only grounding my course, but also our discussion today. And I can go through some of the motivation for why I selected Mayer and Salovey and Caruso's model for purposes of our course. But I would say to you that where Mayer, Salovey, and Caruso really kind of focus on these foundational skills of emotional intelligence, I believe that there's a lot of value in Boyatis and Goleman sort of thinking about how do you employ those skills to these practical work behaviors. There are competencies like resolving conflict and exhibiting empathy and influencing others that are really the competencies that we exhibit in the workplace for which some of the underlying skills that Mayer, Sullivan, Crusoe talk about are necessary precursors.
Wow, so the first thing that jumps out at me as you explore all those different definitions is, firstly, that it's obviously really complicated, really complex, but secondly, that emotions are really important. So emotions seem to be this really rich source of information that can compel us to behave in different ways, and it's really worth a person undertaking the process of trying to understand their emotions in order to motivate different behaviors, to integrate emotions into their personality. All of these things are being implicitly outlined and explicitly outlined by these definitions. And what really strikes me is what a stark chasm there is between this and the mainstream thinking about emotions, particularly in modern life. Do you find in day-to-day life that there's this almost stereotype about emotions, that in this modern information-based landscape, that emotions are this sort of hangover from the past, something they're kind of a nuisance, something we need to get rid of? And if that is a problem that you find, why is this wrong?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, Alex. I think I do find that there's this devaluing of the richness of insight that we can gain when we choose to include emotion in our decision-making process. It is very stereotypical of folks in hard science fields to sort of rely on what the hard data or the quantitative data suggests when arriving at a conclusion. And I think that that's a little bit short-sighted when you consider the fact that emotions impact every aspect of our lives. Every day, we're continually bombarded by stimuli, and it is this immediate, neural reaction in amygdala that causes a response that the prefrontal cortex then chooses to acknowledge in a certain way. And there are differences. People vary in their ability to perceive and use this data. It's a very common example that I use in class is there are oftentimes decisions that executives make in the workplace that may not be in alignment with what the hard data suggests is the right answer. And although that may seem counterintuitive, the reality is that that executive is working with a broader set of data when considering paths forward. I'll never forget my very first sort of managerial responsibility in industry. I was working as a management consultant. It was my very first project that I was leading. And when I arrived on the project, the project sponsor went through sort of our statement of work, what we had to kind of complete for the client. And the sponsor said, the most important thing that I need you to keep in mind is that this particular contract has a milestone payments associated with a bundle of work being completed. And what's most important to me on this contract is that we make every single milestone payment. And knowing that that was his very top priority, the very first thing I did when I opened up the scope of work, the project plan, is I just did simple math. And I said, okay, there are four people on this project, and there are X number of hours to be completed in this batch of work in order to make the milestone payment. And I looked at the calendar, and I said to myself, well, the math doesn't add up. We only had 28 days left to reach the milestone, and we didn't have enough labor hours given who the composition of the team in order to arrive at that milestone payment. Unless, of course, I imposed overtime. It was the only way you could only get so many hours completed out of the current composition of the team by that date if I required people to work more than their standard 8 hours a day. And so I thought this was spectacular analysis. I thought the partner was going to award me for having the foresight to think about this ahead of time. And promptly that very next Monday, I went into his office and I said, I'd like you to support me here. I'm going to mandate overtime for our team because in examining our scope of work, there's no way we're going to meet the milestone payment unless we do that. And I'll never forget, he sat back in his chair and he said, I don't think that's a good idea. And I was kind of dumbfounded. I was like, wait a minute. Like, it's just math. You can only get so much, you can't get more work out of the team unless you impose this overtime. And what he said to me was, you have to kind of think about the ramifications of mandating overtime. He said, you're a brand new manager. You've just been introduced to your team last week. Imagine how they're going to feel if your very first week on the project, you tell them all they have to work overtime. He said, what I would encourage you to do instead of just simply mandating overtime is present the challenge to your team. Present the same analysis that you've completed back to your team, have them internalize it, and then brainstorm creatively with them about how they sort of can arrive at that milestone payment. And his approach, of course, was superior to mine because I followed his advice. And what I found was that by inspiring the team with a challenge, they ended up, you know, having to work some hours, but they also thought a lot more efficiently about the work that had to be done.
Right.
And so in the end, I didn't have to mandate overtime. I didn't have to spend sort of political capital that I didn't have. And we achieved our goal. And I share that example with you because if I would have just relied on math, logic, I would have made a very, very poor decision. And instead, what the partner told me was there's this whole other data set here that you have available around emotions and interpersonal relationships that if you include in that decision-making process, will help you arrive at a more optimal solution.
That's an excellent example. And it really shows how relying on rationality alone may be useful in the short term, but can often get you in trouble in the long term. Like, had you mandated overtime, perhaps they would have done the overtime, perhaps the project would have gotten completed, but like you said, you'd have spent your political capital, much less likely to be on board with you on future projects, and a lot less loyalty there. So really, an elegant solution from your boss. And so was that like your first eye-opening moment in terms of the importance of emotional intelligence?
It was my first, but it wasn't my last. Prior to being an academic, I spent 13 years actually as a management consultant. And what I learned is true in that particular industry, and I think it's applicable to a lot of others as well, is that very early on in my career, I was assessed and rewarded almost exclusively for my technical competency. And I use the word technical very loosely. It could be whatever your area of expertise is, whether it is financial accounting or healthcare delivery, whatever your sort of functional expertise is, you're rewarded predominantly with your ability to sort of work through the mechanics and delivery of your expertise. And that was very true for me as well. As a management consultant, I spent a lot of time early in my career coding, programming. And I found that I was very proficient. I was a very proficient coder. And I seemed to gravitate really well to the logic of, you know, computer programming. I understood algorithms. I understood if-then-else statements. It came very naturally to me. And as a result, early on in my career, I seemed to progress through the career ladder rather quickly. And I say that with all humility. But there was a funny thing that happened in my career as I began to achieve greater levels of exposure in the firm. And certainly as I entered management, what I learned is that less and less of my performance evaluation was based on those technical skills. And more of my evaluation was in fact being assessed on how I actually influenced others, how I built relationships with clients, how my team perceived my management, how I developed members of my team. None of that was taught to me through my schooling in business school, but rather it was a result of these interpersonal, these experiences that I've had in my career, sort of working with others, and these interpersonal skills that I think are so important as you achieve greater levels of leadership in the, in a firm.
So do you think it's fair to say then that you essentially then went about designing the university course you would have wanted when you did your MBA?
Absolutely. I wish I would have, been a student in my own course. The reality is that, you know, for those who you typically hear, not just in business, but any sort of organization, you typically hear of this sort of glass ceiling, right? Where there is some secret sauce, you know, in a funneled pyramid, not everybody is going to achieve the corner office status. And when you sort of think about what is that sort of sorting mechanism, you know, why do we select one candidate over another? Typically, the answer cannot be found in someone's hard skills. By definition, in order to sort of achieve that level in organization, there has to be technical competence. So what is the tiebreaker? What are the things that sort of make us sort of gravitate to one candidate for promotion versus another? And I would argue to you, it comes back to the tiebreaker often is how does the person develop and maintain relationships with others? And, you know, that is, there are folks who, without these emotional intelligence skills, will sort of hit this plateau in their career where they really are good at delivery. They're good at bringing their technical expertise to bear. But in terms of actually leading and managing others, they're never going to be called upon in the same way that someone else with these skills would be.
Yes. Sometimes when I'm listening to answers on the podcast, I'm partly listening with an ear of cynicism. Like what might the more cynical people in the audience think? I think a lot of the time, soft skills like communication skills, emotional intelligence skills are easily derided by saying, oh, you're just, you know, you're making up for a lack of technical skills using these almost manipulative techniques. So I might ask you, you know, for those who are more cynical, what's the difference between emotional intelligence and manipulation?
Yes. So it's interesting you say that. There's there was an article published by Adam Grant, a social psychologist at Wharton, called The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence. And in that article, he points out that there's new evidence that sort of suggests that when people really hone their emotional skills, they become better at manipulating others. In fact, when you know what others are feeling, you can tug at their heartstrings and motivate them to act against their own best interests, perhaps by feigning empathy. But one only need to look to history, to leaders such as Adolf Hitler, who spent years, in fact, studying emotional response to his body language to see the potential dark side of manipulation. This manipulation plays out in a number of ways in the workplace. For example, in a study recently that was conducted in Tel Aviv with a computer programming company, researchers were conversing with a manager in the company, and he told a colleague directly how excited he was at the work that his colleague was doing. But he admitted to researchers that at the same time, he was working to distance himself from his colleague's work because he didn't believe in it and he didn't want to be blamed for its failure when it blew up. So, you know, there is an and he readily admitted that to researchers. So, you know, there is this, this dark side to having these skills. In another example, a University of Cambridge professor named Jochen Menges found that when leaders give very inspiring speeches that are filled with emotion, the audience tends to be less to scrutinize less the message and remembers far less of the content. And he actually coined this phenomenon, the awestruck effect, which is we respond to someone's emotional vigor and we challenge them or critique their message far less frequently. So, you know, there is, I'm glad you brought this up because with any superpower, there is the potential for it to be used for harm. And this is certainly true for these emotional intelligence skills as well.
So it sounds like the kind of razor that can be used to distinguish between, you know, good uses of emotional intelligence and manipulation really is honesty and congruence. Like, are you being transparent about what you want and then using emotional intelligence to help you and those around you achieve those goals? Or are you using emotions surreptitiously, either to obscure the core message or to create a false version of reality? It sounds like honesty seems to be very important here.
Honesty seems to be really important, as does empathy. And I've used that word a couple of times already in the podcast, but I think this displays the importance of empathy. Empathy is this ability to sort of sense others' feelings and take an active interest in their concern. And when you talk about honesty, to me, what comes through is this pureness of intention, right? And that's really what empathy is all about. But, you know, understand that not all empathy is created equal. And sometimes we get it wrong and we respond with the wrong level of empathy. You know, there's sort of in the literature, there's sort of like 3 degrees to an empathetic response. You probably know this, but to recap for your audience, you know, there is this, the first level of sort of an empathetic response is to sort of, we would call this cognitive empathy, but it's being able to sort of perceive what someone else is going through. So it's this idea that if I were in your position, I know what you'd be thinking. And the analogy would be like, if you see somebody out at sea in a boat, you sort of identify with them and say, "Ah, I see you there, you know, out at sea. I see what you're going through." But that level of empathy doesn't really connect us with the other person until we sort of feel the same emotion that they feel. And in that next level of empathy, which is called emotional empathy, it's not only being able to put yourself in someone else's position, but it's also the ability to feel what they feel. So being in your position would make me feel anxious or afraid about being stranded out at sea. So instead of just seeing the boat out to shore, now you're actually in the boat with that person and you're feeling what they're feeling. The third level of an empathetic response, which we'd typically call generative empathy, takes it even one step further. In a generative response, which is sometimes referred to as compassion, it's the idea that not only can I put myself in someone else's shoes, so I'm in the boat, but while I'm in the boat, I'm actively rowing to get that person back to shore. So it's this idea that like I feel what you're feeling so deeply that I'm going to take demonstrative steps to sort of help you feel differently. And, you know, leadership is really about predicting and being able to move people in a specific direction. And I think having concern for someone else's interest is really at the core of this distinction that we're trying to make beyond using emotional skills for good versus using it for harmful purposes. You know, being generative is in always situation is not always practical, but also it's not wanted. And I think that's something to explore a little bit as well. You know, just last week, my mother is staying with me, and I came home from work, and she was sitting very pensively at the kitchen table. And I said, "Mom, what's wrong?" And she said, "Oh my gosh." She said, "I left the coffee pot on all day long, and I know that that's a potential fire hazard, and I'm so sorry that I did that." And me, in my instantaneous reaction, I'm a problem solver. And so what did I do? I immediately pulled out of my briefcase, a little post-it note sticky. And I said, no problem, Mom. We're going to write, turn off on this sticky. I'm going to put it on the front of the coffee pot and it'll be your daily reminder to remember that you're always to shut off your coffee in the morning. And she sat back in her chair and she said, John, that was thoughtful, but that's not why I told you that I left the coffee pot on. And it was this moment of like, doh, like you got this wrong. You responded in a generative way. When all my mom really wanted to, all she really wanted from me is for someone to say, I see what you did. It's okay. Right? I didn't need to solve that problem for her. I didn't need to be generative in my response. But me being a problem solver, I immediately tried to jump in with a generative response in that case. And that's not the type of empathy that my mom wanted at that time. So it's a simple little example. But I think what's important there is understanding your empathetic response should match what your audience is looking for from you.
Absolutely. And that's an example. I think every problem solver in a relationship, and most relationships will have one person that's more predisposed to problem solving than the other one. Every problem solver needs to know about that, that even though problem solvers love to solve problems and see the world as a set of problems that needs to be solved, that's very often not what the other person is looking for. So we've talked about emotional intelligence a little bit. We've covered a few examples. What are the kind of fundamental concepts you like to walk through your students in your course?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, getting back to sort of these two operational definitions that the scholarly community has sort of coalesced around, I did, in fact, choose the Mayer, Saliva, and Caruso model, which are those four distinct abilities of being able to perceive emotion, being able to use emotional data in the decision-making or cognitive process, being able to understand what causes those emotions and their likely progressions, and then being able to manage both your own emotions through self-regulation and the emotions of others in relationships. I chose that model over the Golden model, mainly because I believed in its measurement. In the Mayer, Saliva, and Caruso definition, they developed an accompanying 141-item survey called Mesquite, and that survey measures collectively those four abilities. The assessment takes about 30 to 45 minutes to complete, and it provides this sort of standardized score that assesses the respondent's ability on a scale relative to all test takers. And I think at this point now, they're going to be launching the second revision of the instrument shortly, but they've had over 300,000 test takers. So there's a level of significance to the reported findings here. But essentially, when you are on this sort of sliding scale for these four abilities, you begin, you know, if you're within one standard deviation of the mean, that sort of indicates that you are, relative to all test takers, you are highly competent in that particular skill. It's also true that if you find yourself perhaps one standard deviation below the mean or above the mean, that's either an area for development or an area where you might have particular strength relative to all test takers. But using that particular instrument, which, by the way, has been tested for both construct validity and reliability, which indicates that it is actually measuring what it says it's measuring, and it is a reliable instrument. You can take it multiple times and you're not going to get significantly different results. That sort of sets a baseline for students. And what I tend to do, what I then do in my course is, I think awareness is 9/10 of the battle. You know, do you actually know what your emotional intelligence level is right now? It's like any other cognitive process that it's hard to know unless we have some sort of objective baseline. And so we start the course by sort of everyone administering the survey, having everyone sort of baseline their skills with these four abilities. And then we just kind of go through ability by ability, and we develop exercises to help with practice and skill development. The actual test, let me highlight the survey instrument a little bit because I think this will be illuminating. The survey instrument itself has 8 different tasks in it that are aligned with the 4 abilities. And the first 2 tasks, which are aligned with the perception, the ability to perceive emotion in ourselves and others, are related to recognizing facial expressions and generating emotion from art or pictures. And it works under this premise that there are some universal responses to facial expression. And I get this question a lot, especially with our international students who say, you know, not all emotions are expressed the same way in every geography or every country. While that's true, that's relatively nuanced. And what Mesquite actually measures is those sort of emotions that are sort of universally understood. So, for example, a frown is always conveyed as sadness in every geography and in every culture, right? So, you know, a lot of times with this upfront perception skill, it's not necessarily that in interacting with someone else that you don't actually, or you aren't aware of their emotion. It may also be true that you just choose to ignore it. You know, if you're very focused, if you're very task driven and you have to get something done, you know, you've heard that famous expression that's used very flippantly is, I don't care how you feel, we have to get this done, right? And in that scenario, you're sort of articulating in a very demonstrative way that emotions aren't important to the task at hand. So that upfront perception skill is all about sort of this, I think it's more of a trigger, and it's cueing yourself that no. Understanding how someone else is feeling is data that I ought to collect, and it's equal to, as in some cases, more important to the hard data that we have to be able to make decisions. So that's how we sort of measure this perception skill. When we move on and talk about using it in the cognitive process, the tests and the instrument that sort of measure that are tests related to facilitation. So how do you use emotional data to arrive at conclusions? And then this a task called sensations, which is most really directly related to empathy. But it's about, can you identify with the feeling of someone else and then begin to feel the same way in a given situation? When we talk about the third skill, which is being able to understand root causes and the likely progression or intensity of emotions, the way that that's measured in Mesquite is through 2 tasks related to changes of emotions over time. So understanding when, you know, melancholy turns into sadness and sadness turns into despair. So there's a certain evolution of emotions, understanding that, and then understanding that emotions are sort of complex and not everyone experiences them in the same way. And then the last 2 tasks are really related to understanding how to manage your own emotions and emotions of others. And this is around self-regulation. So understanding that it's very important for us to understand how we feel, but then we have a choice about whether or not we express how we genuinely feel or whether we truly mask it. And when we choose to mask it, that's what we call self-regulation. And, you know, a common myth about emotional intelligence is that in every situation, it's always preferable to be in a positive, to emote positively. And that's simply not true. You know, it doesn't mean that someone with high emotional intelligence is always happy. That's not true at all. And in fact, there are some tasks that are more appropriate to be completed when you have a negative emotion, you know, when you're feeling really angry. That's the time to sort of lean into correcting injustices, right? Because you're going to be very driven and want to solve that problem. When we are feeling happy, that tends to be that those tend to be times when we really want to engage in, for example, the creative process. We know that when you are when you have positive emotion, you tend to be more creative, and you tend to be more innovative in your thinking. So it's about that last ability is really about matching my emotion to the task at hand. And we know, for example, that when you get passed over for promotion, you're probably going to be pretty angry about that. But self-regulation says my immediate response shouldn't be go into my boss's office and pound on the table. In fact, a better approach is perhaps practice some self-regulation and maybe draft a nasty email and then put it in the draft folder, right? and never actually send it and come back to it the next day when you've had a sleep and a time to think over it. So that's sort of how the instrument assesses these four abilities. And then we really just practically go through, and it's sort of like skill development. We've have a bunch of different practice exercises that give students the opportunity to really, once they know their baseline, they know where their skill development needs to focus. And then we just practice exercises in the classroom. That's sort of the structure of the course.
So many points I want to pick up on. I mean, firstly, the point about negative emotion is so important. I see this all the time in psychotherapy clinically. So many of us want to run away from negative emotion. We want to dissociate ourselves from it in one form or another. One of the most common reasons I see clients for therapy is they don't know how to use assertiveness/aggression. They don't want anything to do with any kind of aggressive impulse. And what people don't realize is there's a kind of spectrum where at one end, there's simply asserting how you feel and what you want and trying to take what you want in life, which is important. And it's a continuous spectrum from that to violence, with every shade in between. And in an effort to give up, I think, the nastier aspects of aggression, a lot of people give up on everything wholesale. And if you don't have that ability to deploy aggression tactically, I imagine particularly in a business setting, you're really fighting with one arm tied behind your back. It's very, very difficult. And then the other point you mentioned about self-regulation, you know, self-regulation as a masking, what I would say is, I mean, obviously there are one form of it is masking. You know, sometimes you plainly feel one way and you want to show that you're feeling a different way because it's not really appropriate or not really the best move strategically. And then there's a whole separate debate about the dishonesty, how dishonest that is, but that's complicated. But I would also say self-regulation is the ability to actually change your emotional state, which I think is possible. And I wonder, have you been influenced at all by dialectical behavior therapy? Because that's had a lot to do with different techniques, ranging from more superficial techniques to mindfulness, to things like that, in order to actually not just mask your emotional state, but to change it.
I'm not as well versed in the literature as you. However, I'm glad that you mentioned mindfulness, because that is something that I believe firmly in as a mechanism to change emotions relatively quickly, in fact. So there is, you know, mindfulness that is practiced sort of out of habit, sort of like a daily routine. And then there is sort of these micro practices that you can initiate at any time throughout the day when you really need to change your emotion for the situation that you're in. And I believe very firmly in those micro practices. In fact, what we know about mindfulness is that it enhances productivity, it reduces anxiety, and it creates a greater sense of presence, cognitive presence. And so I've incorporated these micro practices in the start of my classes. You know, I'm requiring my students to sit and listen to me for 90 minutes. And with that length of time, I understand that that's a challenge to be fully cognitive present for that length of time. And so one way that we do this is we start every class with just this 1 minute of mindfulness, where I ask everyone to sort of shut down, perhaps practice some breathing techniques, close their eyes, and just think about the answer to one singular question. And that is, how am I feeling in the moment? And it's amazing how when you really just shut down and get rid of all of that other cognitive load, it brings complete awareness in a way that now it's useful information to you if, in fact, you need to sort of change how you're feeling. And, you know, lots of organizations now have formal mindfulness trainings. It's incorporated in, into the awareness of the way that many professional organizations operate today. And I do think that is particularly helpful in situations to prevent you from expressing an emotion that might not be helpful in context, to be able to literally just physically remove yourself from that environment, even for just 5 minutes, can be incredibly refreshing and prevent you from perhaps responding in a way that's not productive or conducive to the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in the business world at all, but I'm sure 5 minutes can be the difference between losing your job and getting a promotion.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, surprisingly, I thought it would be kind of a tough sell, especially amongst business students who are so analytically focused and focused on all the rest of their coursework is all about logic, right? And I run in, you know, the classroom, my very first class, I said, okay, we're going to now practice mindfulness. And I thought that I would be met with a lot of resistance and a lot of skepticism. But to my surprise, even business students recognize the importance of really taking an inventory, understanding how you present, and really, I position it as trying to make sure that they get the most out of our time together.
And you've got such an interesting, it's like you have a little micro lab. You have, you know, these isolated groups of business students, as you say, typically pretty analytically minded, and you're running them through mindfulness and all these emotional techniques, and you're measuring their emotional intelligence at the start. And I'm really curious, what did the results for a class tend to look like? Do you find, for example, that people tend to have one, be really strong in one of those four attributes? Or if someone's strong in one, do they tend to be strong in the other three? How is it distributed?
You know, it's interesting. This semester, I had 43 students in the class, and every one of them took the baseline assessment. And I can tell you with complete transparency that not one singular report looked like another. People were all over the place. I mean, it was, there was no real rhythm. Even amongst what would otherwise be a homogenous group, you know, these are all MBA students who've been for the past 2 years, basically had the same experience at the same university. That homogenous group really looked very heterogeneous when we applied the emotional intelligence assessment. There were students who were really high on the perceptive skill, so they could perceive with great accuracy how others were feeling, but yet then chose in the cognitive process to ignore all that data and just run with logic. There were other students who really appreciated the value of emotional data, but just didn't seem to be accurately identifying what those emotions were. And it was really all over the board. And it was such a an interesting exercise, because what I required in my class was a 1 hour debrief with every student. And I can tell you no debriefs look the same. Everyone was very unique and very specific to that individual. But I think it provided each student with this insight about, here are some things I'm particularly strong about, and here are some things that I really need to work on in order to get sort of my skills, you know, across the board. What I can say, I guess, in sort of talking through this, is that there was no one who was across all four abilities, two standard deviations above on all of them. nor was there any single student who was two standard deviations below on all of them. So there was no correlation between the abilities, and where people were on that spectrum was very, very unique.
And would you then measure their abilities at the end of the class once they've learned all the techniques and the content?
Yeah, that's sort of the holy grail. I would love to sort of know if my interventions, that's sort of like my course evaluation, right? So did my interventions work? This was a short form MBA course, so we had 8 weeks and we didn't go back. And quite frankly, I don't think that in 8 weeks, you're going to see this dramatic statistical difference in any of these skills, but rather I'd like to use this cohort and be able, now that it's in their consciousness and they have the tools to improve these skills, I'd like to retest them in 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
And I'd like to see if they've continued, you know, in this course, I had every student sort of put together their continual development plan. And I'd love to measure them in 2 or 3 years and to see for those who sort of, I put this in their consciousness, they have training exercises kind of continue to work on, 2 or 3 years from now, did we actually move the needle? That would be an interesting test.
And I'm also thinking about, as you're talking, the Big Five model of personality. And I don't know if this is something that's been correlated with Mesquite at all, but I know nothing about Mesquite, but I know quite a lot about the Big Five. And it occurs to me that knowing someone's Big Five score, and for those of you who don't know, you know, I've done whole episodes about this, so I'll link them in the description. But knowing your score on the Big Five traits of personality will probably give you a really good indication of where someone will lie on those four traits of emotional intelligence. So, for example, someone who's really introverted, I would imagine they'd actually be quite good at perceiving the emotions of other people, but they might be less assertive with their own emotions. Is that something you've looked into as well?
Yeah, intuitively that makes sense. Statistically, we haven't been able to confirm that particular correlation. There are two that we can confirm through data. The first is that those that are high on the conscientiousness spectrum tend to also be really high on emotional management and self-regulation. So there's this belief that the more conscientious I am, the more steps I take to sort of take care of the relationship that I have with others and also my own self-care. And the other one is that there is a negative correlation between neuroticism and all four of the abilities. So, and that one makes sense to me, right? Someone who is very self-interested wouldn't necessarily be lower on this not only willingness to sort of collect emotional data, but also lacking the ability to find utility in using the emotional data. So those two correlations are very strong in the data, but I'm sure there's others that we could study and find as well.
I have a bit of a complicated question. In my experience, a lot of times people are quite shut off from their emotional lives because of difficult experiences or trauma, anywhere in between. And sometimes when you start to reacquaint them with their emotions through psychotherapy, but I imagine even through a class like yours, can be a very difficult and destabilizing experience. I think these are people who might rely too much on the masking we talked about earlier, just frankly not acknowledging and repressing how I'm feeling, which is really useful in the short term, really useful in a business meeting. But some people do that for their whole lives. That's how they cope, you know, for one reason or another. And do you find that when people start to discover this content, when they do mindfulness, when they start to be reacquainted with their emotions, that it can be destabilizing? Or maybe you noticed yourself in your personal life?
It can be, and those are sort of extreme. It could be a result of extreme cases of trauma. But also, I think when it's not sort of those extreme examples, I think it's helpful. You know, there were a number of students this past semester who, after going through the course, said, you know, I thought that I had successfully processed the death of an elderly grandparent. Until I got to the course, I realized I hadn't really. And although those feelings of discomfort were confronted in the class, not directly through any lecture, but as a consequence of assignments and reflection, they felt a lot better about the situations, as a result of being confronted with not the impetus that I put to not suppress those feelings anymore. So it was like sort of unlocking the box and all of this emotion kind of spewed out. And although there was some hard work in processing it, I think everyone, and I'm sure this is what you find in your work every day, is that being able to process it in the end is a helpful and beneficial thing. And to the extent that it causes a little bit of discomfort up front, provided it's not an extreme trauma case, I think students find it very helpful.
Yeah, definitely. I would say in the main, like facing a little bit of discomfort voluntarily, consistently is a really good thing. And that's like a heuristic I use for everything. If you want to improve your physical health, face a little bit of discomfort voluntarily every day. That's like, could look like going to the gym. If you want to improve your emotional intelligence, face a little bit of discomfort regularly, you know, do something that's slightly scary. You don't want to overwhelm yourself. But in most cases, people won't be overwhelming themselves. And I do think there is a, you know, I think we're in a society that's trying to become more emotionally intelligent. And sometimes we can overcompensate by saying, you know, all difficult experiences are trauma. And if we try and face any discomfort, we're going to overwhelm people. And I think that's importantly wrong. I think we're built for discomfort. When I interview a lot of clinicians, I ask them what they've learned the most about human nature. Almost all of them say what they've learned, what surprised them the most is just how resilient we are. And of course we are, you know, we've faced conditions as a species that are so much harsher than what we face now in many ways. We have our difficulties, but it's really worth knowing that the human species is a species that's really adapted towards and built to manage difficult situations and actually take away difficulty and we all go crazy, Elizabeth.
Yes, I agree with that completely. And I do think that there is, it's always a much more expeditious route to make decisions with less data than more, right? Because it oftentimes will present fewer alternatives, and the consequences of those alternatives tend to be more stark. And I think in today's fast-paced society, we just naturally try to be much more efficient because we have 30 problems to solve today, not just 3. And it does take someone to have the initiative to say, I know it would be easier if I ignore this entire data set around emotions and just drive decision-making off logic. But if I slow down and I consider a more comprehensive data set, I might be in the long run much more satisfied with the alternatives that I'm able to generate and subsequently the outcome that I choose. And I think that's where you get the tension between, am I solving problems today in a very tactical way in order to get something done? Or am I solving problems for the long term in a way that is mutually beneficial to other parties and builds better relationships? I think that's a choice we have to make.
Yeah, and it's complicated. I've found that in my own training, you have to develop a palette for your emotions and start. It's a process. It's not like you have these emotions and you go from Tuesday not understanding them to Wednesday now you understand them. You have to develop a taste for them, like what's the difference between jealousy and envy, or what's the difference between sadness and melancholy. And as you start to develop a finer sense for all the different shades of emotions that you can have, then you know, yes, it's more complicated, but if you go through that process and maybe it takes a couple of years to figure out, then you have a much more sophisticated toolkit when it comes to both dealing with yourself, but also dealing with other people. And on that note, you know, I'd like to ask you, where does, I like to think about things not in just in terms of relationships to others, but also relationship to self. How does, as someone embarks on this process, how does someone's relationship to themselves change?
I think that by, I've noticed two things. The first is that when it becomes a part of someone's conscious routine to be evaluating how they're feeling, there is this level of authenticity that they begin to experience, that they're no longer playing a character. Individuals are no longer delivering to society what society wants, but they are living more authentically. You know, they're by being more in tune with their feelings, they understand that they are an individual, very different and distinct from the other 3 billion people in the world. And they have this real sense that they're living a more authentic life. The second sort of insight that I have in working with students through this course is that students have a lot more, they're much more forgiving of themselves. So they understand, right, that it's part of the human condition to experience envy, to experience jealousy, to experience anger. And where in the past they may have viewed those negative emotions as somehow an imperfection in who they were, now that they are sort of monitoring and charting that they experience all of the emotions, both positive and negative, multiple times throughout the day, it becomes this catharsis that's sort of like, okay, I guess it just means that I'm human. When I am envious of my peer because they got a job offer and I didn't, it's just part of the human condition. I'm okay with that, experiencing that emotion.
Yes, and as soon as you start talking about job offers, you're striking at the fear at the heart of every MBA student.
Yes, and you know, a lot of, I taught this course in the spring, which is right before graduation. And so there was a lot of anxiety amongst this particular cohort with jobs. And several students would come in and say, you know, I know I shouldn't feel this way, but I'm very envious of so-and-so who just reported a job offer, and I should be really happy for them and I should be ecstatic, but I'm not. I'm sort of jealous. And as sort of through the conversation, it's like, that's a natural emotion and you shouldn't apologize for that. That's part of the human condition. And I think it's just this understanding. I think students come to this understanding that being able to experience all of those emotions is what it means to be human, and they're a lot more forgiving when they experience those negative emotions of themselves.
Yes. Well, John, you know, we've talked about a lot today. We're out of time, but there's a lot more I want to talk to you about. So we'll definitely have you back at some point in the future. But thank you so much for joining us. Is there a place people can go to find out more information on these topics? And maybe can they access the Mesquite assessment themselves?
Yep. I know it's going to sound a little bit like a paid advertisement, but let me assure you, it's not. I really kind of believe the first step for those of our listeners who want to sort of begin developing their own emotional intelligence skills, much like I set up in the course, I think the very first step in the process is to baseline their own skills. Whether you choose to take the Mesquite assessment or Goleman Biasis's ESCI inventory, it's really important for listeners to understand what their baseline is. Once they have that kind of baseline, there are lots of ways to sort of practice building those skills. In fact, this shouldn't surprise you, but there are quite a few apps that provide exercises for improving emotional intelligence. I kind of prefer some lo-fi techniques. We don't have time to go through a lot of them, but you know, I would encourage folks to initiate a journaling process if they don't have one already, by just sort of asking themselves on a daily basis, how are they feeling and what did they encounter today that made others feel a specific way. I would also encourage listeners to maybe enlist a confidant in their own skill development. So someone who you really trust, who isn't going to be judging of the way that you feel or how you respond to stimuli in the environment. This is a great way to sort of keep us honest on things like getting the right level of empathy and not misreading how someone else is feeling. And then I would really encourage listeners to think about hard scheduling self-care. And I know that's, again, in a fast-paced society, that's not always possible. But by hard scheduling, what I mean is like literally putting in your diary, every Friday I'm going to swim class, or every Thursday I'm gonna go to the art museum. Just things that you need in order to sort of rest and recover. To make you emotionally and cognitively present. I think that's another tip or trick that I would have for folks who really want to focus on improving the way that they manage emotions in their daily lives.
Perfect. Professor John Wisniewski, thanks so much for coming on.
It was truly delightful. Thank you, Alex.